Hey, you got the morning show with Aaron. And in the studio, I have Crystal from the Karioi Project. Stop scrolling and say hello, Crystal.
Morena.
Yes.
I'm not scrolling. I'm showing you the beautiful pictures.
Oh, are those? Is that a penguin? What am I looking at? Oh, no, that's the.
Do you need some glasses?
Yeah, pretty much.
No, that's a little grey-faced petrel.
Oh, you forget chick. How big they are.
Yeah, that's. Well, that chick, I mean, so it's probably like the size of. Like, what would you call that? Like a chicken.
Yeah.
Stuffed
except
chicken.
It's a ball of grey fluff.
Yeah, but I don't know, like 6-7 weeks ago, it was the size of my palm.
So how big is the egg?
About that. Like it's bigger than a chicken egg.
A little bit bigger.
A little bit bigger, but not a lot bigger.
Okay. But do they end up much bigger than a chicken?
No.
Because you see these photos of them flying. Looks beautiful. You've got no idea of the scale.
The body's quite streamlined and skinny, so it's skinnier than a chicken.
Yeah.
But the wingspan's like about a meter.
Like, oh,
it's
wow.
Amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I guess when you see them on the ground, you can kind of compare it to a chicken size, but it's nowhere near as fat as a chicken.
Yeah, yeah.
And because they have to fly. And then the wings are incredible.
But at the moment, fluff.
Yeah.
Mostly grey fluff.
Yeah, so that
chick actually looks like my vacuum cleaner bag.
Yeah.
To be honest.
Yeah. That chick, you probably can't see in the photo. It was just getting the adult plumage from the tail, coming out of the tail.
Okay.
That's where it starts. And then also a really cool thing, like people really notice is like, oh, it's got webbed feet. Everyone was going, oh, look, it's got webbed feet. And then it's got these sharp little claws on the end, so it helps them for digging.
Okay.
You know, so it's got these multi-purpose little feet.
It's a cross between a chicken and a duck.
Yeah.
Except it can fly as well.
Yeah.
Like nicely.
And dive.
And dive. They spend all their time on the wing out at sea.
Yeah.
Don't they? I mean, how long can they spend in the air? Do we know that?
A long time, because they can kind of lock in their wings, but they also sit on the water.
Yeah. So how are the chicks doing at the moment?
Yeah, they're doing pretty good. Like, still monitoring all the burrows. I haven't caught up on the last count, but it was sitting somewhere between 15 and 20.
That's pretty good,
burrows.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it's really
active
good.
Burrows. Yep. And how many chickens? Is it usually one chick in a burrow?
Yeah, one chick in a burrow. Okay. And then we also have the little blue penguins. And we've got, you know, about 8 or so burrows of those as well.
Right, one chick?
Yeah. Sorry. For the little blues, there's twins as well.
Okay, that's a thing. See, the thing I've noticed with all the species that are endangered is they don't breed like rabbits.
No.
Which is obviously clearly a handicap, but there's nothing that's going to obviously change about that in a hurry. So,
and they live a long time, so like up to 30 years. And then also, like, it's natural for them to put, like, the adult puts its own life before its chick. So if there's not enough food or something happens out at sea, they'll abandon the nest. And then they just come back the next year and lay another egg. So because the adult lives for like 30 years, like it's not going to abandon, you know, and not survive for itself first. So, you know, like looks after number one, puts its own face mask on first before it puts on
the
chick's face mask.
It looks after the species, I guess, is the way of saying it.
Yeah.
It's funny, if we try to apply human values to that, we're like, oh my God, that's awful, but that's actually if we want them to survive, that's what they need to do.
Yeah.
So has there been, like every year we tend to lose some from invasions, stoat invasions and things like that. Has that happened yet this year?
We haven't had a major incursion. Like we had a few threats earlier on in the season where we probably did lose a few burrows.
Yeah.
And then like we've had like threats from dogs more this year. Dogs roaming around and probably getting a few adults that were roaming around outside the burrows, but they didn't get any of the breeding pairs. So we also get young birds just visiting colonies and coming to land and sometimes finding a place to start a burrow, but they might not be breeding yet.
Right.
So all those scenarios happen. And so, it's a bit of a wild world out there for them.
Mm.
There's all these threats both on land and at sea. And so probably the biggest thing we've had this year so far is that we found a whole bunch of dead birds between Ruapuki and Ngāra Nui Beach
over the
last 2 weeks. So, so we had some of them identified, and it was probably about 15 to 20 that we've found so far. And that was a mixture of the grey-faced petrel and shearwaters. And
were they washed ashore?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So well, we don't know if they washed or crashed, but like, yeah, then we don't quite know how they ended up there, but it does happen. And there was an initial scare, like, oh, heck, could this be bird flu? But it wasn't. They got tested by MPI and stuff. Yeah. And but the thing is probably that, and this is kind of what we talk about. Seabirds connect us to the rest of the world and how they tell a story of what's happening out at sea.
Mm.
And so, say, when temperatures in the North Pacific, kind of like temperature increases, will maybe reduce food availability. And so there might be more starvation events. So the birds will come in lighter and they start migrating when, you know, when they don't have enough weight on their body, and then they perish before they get back, you know, back here.
So if it's warm in the Pacific, the warm water...
Yeah, so warm so water affects food source, right? So like fish will respond to temperature increases by going deeper.
Yeah.
And so these birds, different birds, like shearwaters, petrels, whatever, like they all have different diving depths. And so if you're a bird that only dives, say, 8 or 9 meters, and fish stocks are moving down or away or changing or even overfishing, all those things impact on how the birds feed. Mm. And I mean, there's that, like, this is a bit of a simplified kind of vision, but there's that film called How Whales Change Climate.
I have not seen that.
Oh, you should watch it. It's the same as How Wolves Change Rivers. And it basically explains the ecological kind of theory around why every species matter.
Mm.
And it kind of shows how whales, like the way they dive and churn up the sea, like, you know, like for the smaller krill and species to feed, they need plankton. And plankton needs mixing so that there's enough nutrients so the plankton can feed, and then the plankton surges up, and then the invertebrates come in like krill and they feed on them, and then the fish feed on them, and then the birds come in and feed on them, and then the whales actually churn up the water and create that kind of mixing of the different zones in the water body. I don't explain it as well as the film, obviously. But anyway, the point is that
waving your arms around.
Yeah. Everything is kind of interconnected.
Mm, yeah.
And so when things happen out at sea, like, and as temperatures increase, especially water to sea temperatures, that affects the birds as well. And so often one of the first things that can happen is that they don't put enough weight on, and then when they start flying, migrating back to the mainland and wherever they breed, they don't make it.
Is the oi migratory?
Well, they're migratory as in the oi not as far. Like, so the grey-faced petrel only probably between here and Australia and then in the you know, either Tasman or Pacific. But there's other bird species that go much further, like Japan, North and South America, Antarctic, you know, kind of Arctic waters. So
yeah.
So they've done put trackers on birds and seen how they, and they'll just crisscross all over the sea, waving my hands again, crisscross all over the sea, and then they show the tracker just as they turn to go back to land for breeding season. The tracker just goes boom, straight line. It's incredible. So that
no one really knows how they know.
Well, they use probably, you know, their kind of little remote GPS in their heads, and then sight, smell, and everything as well. So yeah, so it's just really incredible because they literally find this spot on the coast again. I mean, I'd have a hard time flying across from Australia to here, but these birds do it. They're super smart.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's instinctual, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's not like they're
bird smart.
They've got their calendar out, and they're planning, this is the day, this is the journey,
yeah,
and all that. But so some of them have, a few of them may have not made it back in time, or
yeah,
so it's not that many. 20, mind you, so you haven't checked the whole coast of the west.
No,
west coast,
but it's more when they all come at once and it happens that is, you know, it is significant.
Yeah.
But it was not a complete disaster.
No,
but it's something that, you know, we have to be aware of, because it happened out at Murawai as well. They were finding birds there as well. Guy called it in.
Okay.
So it's not just here. It's all along the coast.
It is.
Yeah.
Mm.
And it's just things that we need to be aware of.
Yeah, and you talk about that connectedness. Like if the seabirds disappear, then they're also not coming up under the mountain and pooing minerals and nutrients that that comes through their system from the sea onto the mountain. That changes the mountain as well, the ecosystem up there.
Yeah, like New Zealand forests completely were dependent on the nutrients coming in from the sea.
Yeah.
And that was brought into our forest, like right inland. Like when we talk about New Zealand, the whole of New Zealand is seabird island.
Right.
You know, it wasn't just at Kariwa, they would have gone as far as Mangatauturi and
Yeah, so you have to be like, it's Australia you have to go to find land where the seabirds don't penetrate all the way in. Although not that there's a lot going on in the middle of Australia, but but maybe that's why. Because look, Australia's like a very old, I'm getting into an area I don't really know what I just remember reading, like they're a very old place and the fertility of the soil is very different to what we have here with our volcanoes and earthquake activity and then we're on the coast with the seabirds. So So okay, it's reasonably good news at this time of the year.
It is reasonably good news. Yep, like we're kind of inching towards Christmas and then it's always fingers crossed. It's also this time of year, if the conditions are right, like the stoats start running, we kind of call it.
Ah.
It's when the little baby stoats start fledging from their nests.
Fledging.
Or I don't know, what do you call it?
Leave
the nest, the nest.
Yeah.
So that's always kind of like we're kind of on high alert because those young, I think they're called kittens when they're small, but young stoats.
Yeah.
When they come out, like they obviously a big threat because they come out looking for food and they go on a bit of a rampage. We also catch more stoats over that kind of summer period and it's a really vulnerable time for the birds.
So you've got all your traps primed and ready to go, that sort of thing.
We always have them and we do a lot of camera work, so like camera monitoring, so we can kind of see what's coming and going. And so like recently, like we had a possum that was sniffing around because they can be equally they're opportunists and they can go into a burrow and cause havoc.
Do they eat animals? Possums?
Yeah,
they do.
Yeah, they're omnivores. Yeah, they'll eat eggs.
Yeah,
and they probably could eat. They might not eat a chick, but they could damage it.
Mm.
You know, and the chick's only got its little beak.
Well, we've seen a possum. Kind of a possum could damage a human being, so.
Wow, that's right,
Easily damage a little chick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dogs have been a bit of a problem this year. I think just not being aware and especially not realising that the burrows are so close to the beach.
Mm.
And it's not just both of them are really close to the kind of waterline, high water mark, but especially the little penguins, they like right on the beach. And and of course the penguins come in every day at night and leave again in the morning. So we've got some really great footage on our social media of like some of the penguins like hanging out outside the burrows like middle of the night.
Yeah.
So amazing footage. And it just kind of shows how present they are. So when you've got, roaming dogs and cats out there, it's really dangerous for them.
Are there more dogs this year? I don't
know. It's like, it's definitely become a bit of a thing this year, like that we've seen more dogs around and people are reporting them. I don't know. I mean, maybe it is a little thing, but for us it's an opportunity to educate and say to people, hey, just be aware that this is, not great and can you do something about it? Mm. And what we've found is that most of the dog owners that we've talked to are like really willing to, help out with that. But
so have you guys been going out, hanging out around down that end of the beach?
Sometimes we can ID the dogs from camera work we do, and then we see the collar or we might reach out to neighbors and they know whose dog it is.
Yeah.
So we try not to put it on notice board. We try not to get into that because it's just contentious and it's not nice, And what I've found is that most dog owners feel really bad, as I do, when my dog's not behaving. It makes you feel horrible and you don't want to be that person.
Yeah.
So we try and be kind.
There's no need to run them out of town.
Yeah, for sure. So it's just kind of trying to, learning to live together and maybe, in the future we can do some training around, you know, wildlife avoidance for dogs and that, you know, and trying to teach, you know, how do we teach our dogs to kind of ignore those, you know, things on the beach and not chase birds.
Yeah.
Not chasing birds is a good one. Like sometimes people think that's a really great thing. Oh, my dog chases birds. It's so cute. And maybe like kind of trying to teach, you know, like because also the other thing I'm seeing, it's not just those species, it's also the shorebirds. Like we've got reef herons and spoonbills and all sorts of birds on our shores, like in the estuary and out, you know, by the bay and the playground and that. And we just want to teach our dogs not to be running after them.
Is that easy to do? I feel like our dog would be hard work.
Yeah, well, then you have to have them on the lead.
Yeah. Like that's the obvious thing.
Yeah, and just if you see the birds, just put it on the lead. You know, just be aware
of it. Especially this time of year.
Yeah.
If you do it at any time, you do it at this time.
Yeah.
Keep them on the lead and make sure they don't get out if you live around those areas.
Yeah.
Be extra vigilant.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely having a bit of a time, like, training my dog at the moment, and she's got into some bad habits, and I'm just kind of having to commit to spending more time kind of addressing those issues, and online trainers are really good.
What's that?
Online trainers, like, you know, just a training kind of app where they give you all the information online, like, you don't have to necessarily go to a training, you know, or...
So there was you didn't give us a URL then or anything?
No.
It's just a description. Check it out online.
Like lots of online kind of training apps that teach you kind of what to do around bad dog behaviour and that.
Yeah. And onto a different topic, I understand that the Regional Council came out for a visit to the Karioi project recently.
Yes. So they've obviously been a big funder for us over the last 10 years or so.
Yeah.
And like quite honestly, we couldn't do it without that kind of background funding, you know, that really holds up the whole project.
Yes.
So just super grateful for that, and that's obviously people, you know, some of people's rates going into that community fund. But the nice thing about that fund, it's a really tangible thing that comes back into this community. So that we get Natural Heritage Fund, and we've just put in a new application, so it was quite timely that not all the councillors came, but a handful came and kind of came and visited the boroughs, and we got to tell the story about the project and how the community's involved and all the programs that we run.
And
it was just a really nice time to share, and they like super supportive, super like excited. And like,
for people who don't know, the Regional Council is not the District Council. Lisa Thompson's the councillor for the District Council. The Regional Council, it goes all the way across to the Kaimais, up to Auckland, down to Lake Taupo, I think, all the way down there.
Yeah.
So
it's land, water and sea.
Yeah, so there's people who live quite a long way away from us who are on that council who may not know much about our community.
Yeah. So one of the councillors actually that came was from Taupo. So, yeah, it was really cool.
Yeah.
And, so Terence and I were out there, like, showing them around. And, yeah, it was just a good time.
Did you take them up the mountain?
Did you make them check some traps? We should have, eh?
Give them a hands-on experience.
It was just a couple of hours, and, you know, they have lots of meetings. And they also, like, I gave them a bit of tongue-in-cheek. I was like, oh, you guys also have other jobs. You know, so, yeah, they do all have other jobs, I think. You know, like Bruce Clarkson's still at university, a professor.
Yeah.
Pamela's
story must be full-time because she's the chairperson.
But she's from a farm as well, you know, you know, there's kind of home life as well, I guess. I don't know. But, yeah, no, a lot of those guys do. Actually, there's a few of them that are farmers. One of the farmers that came that's a counselor, you know, the counselor, he's like, oh, it was just really cool to see, like, how, you know, our rural communities really getting into this biodiversity gig.
Yeah.
And, like, improving farms and waterways and improving biodiversity on farms has become a real thing, and I think encouraging those positive steps that people are making is kind of what we want to be doing.
I think it should be fairly well recognised by now. I think that biodiversity makes for a healthy farm and a more efficient, functional farm as well, as well as just a nicer place to be.
Yeah,
all that sort of stuff. Yeah,
yeah,
and. Cool. And you also wanted to talk about the backyard hub at the moment. So we're just talking about rural stuff and what's happening out of town, but you've got a lot of people trapping in town as well.
Yeah. So before I came on, I was just catching up with Isabel, and she runs our backyard hub and backyard hub plus. We have two.
What's the plus?
You're confused. Plus is our paid service. It's our social enterprise.
Right.
So if you don't want to check the traps yourself, we can do it for you.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we have some big landowners like that might have up to 50 traps. And we're protecting all their native, you know, bush sites and that.
Yeah, yeah.
But we also have landowners that might only have a few traps, but they don't live here or they don't want to deal with traps, but, you know, they don't want to put out toxins. So, yeah, so we've got a few gigs like that where we do the trapping for people and set it all up for them.
Okay.
We're also kind of working, like, say, with Rangatahi Peninsula, where we've set up three trap lines for them. So we've just put in a new trap line for them. From the back of Rangatahi, kind of across the subdivision, to like have a bit of a possum barrier, so catching lots of possums out there. So we kind of like work in different ways with different people. Backyard Hub Plus, Backyard Hub is all about getting landowners to get on board and do either their own trapping. And if you don't want to do your own trapping, we can set it up for you as part of our Backyard Hub Plus.
Yeah,
and then it's a paid service.
Okay.
Yep.
And you also, as well as just getting the service, you're helping support the Karua project as well.
Yeah, yeah. So it creates employment for some of our young rangers, and provides about a day a week of employment for someone on our team.
Okay.
Which is really cool.
Yeah, that's cool.
And so it's kind of ticks a few boxes, and then. Part of it's just getting the community involved, and the network of traps we have across our region, kind of between, excuse me, Aotea Harbour and Whangaroa Harbour and the Divi, is incredible.
How many traps can you say off the top of your head? How many traps are out there?
Yeah, there's nearly 2,000 traps.
Right.
Yeah, and that's not even the ones counting on the mountain.
Right. Do you need a drink of water, Crystal? Is it maybe time to go before you die in the studio?
So, yeah. Oh, yes, please. But anyway, yeah, so that's exciting. And so we kind of need to do another push on the Backyard Hub, really keen to get people on board. If you hear about the program and you're keen to get traps, we sell them for reasonable rates. We train you up. We show you how to use them, get you registered. And lots of people also record what they catch on our Trap NZ app.
Yeah.
And so it's really cool to see what the community contributes in terms of predator control. And if you do have traps already, don't forget to check them. Because we all get slack. So anyway, there you go, Isabel, if you're listening. I did it.
Put a plug in for
expect
the service.
Expect lots of phone calls and emails in the next couple of weeks before Christmas. Oh, that's the thing. If you want to get a really cool present, you can get a trap for someone for Christmas. Actually, I just this morning got a rat out of my roof. So they're definitely around and they're still coming inside, and there's like little rats kind of being born every day in your backyard or in your roof. So it's a really good time to trap.
This is the fear mongering coming out.
It's gross.
Day by day, every day a new rat.
Yep.
Yeah. This is a complete aside, and you probably don't know, but I know that Sanctuary Mountain, the Mangatauteri, they were really struggling with funding. Have you heard anything at all? Are you on the network that knows about what's happening over there with them?
No, I haven't caught up with Helen for a while.
Should I ask Bexy? Because Bexy's closer, because Bexy does the connection work with the
Shall I flick Helen the message now? How's your money going? They haven't shut the gates yet. But yeah, actually one really cool other way that you could support projects is there's a Kiwi House in Otrahonga, there's Mangatauteri. Is if you're looking for gift ideas, is like to buy someone a pass, like an entry ticket to one of those sanctuaries or mountains, you know, that are doing that kind of work. And some of them do have an entry fee.
Yeah, your Mangatauteri does.
Mangatauteri and the Kiwi House in Otrahonga does too.
You'd expect
it's actually not cheap to go to that Kiwi House, but it's super cool and it's a really cool gift to give someone.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, there we go. Any gifts for the Karioi project?
Oh, yes.
Shirts?
True.
You're selling merch?
Yes.
You're wearing merch?
Yeah, we have T-shirts, we have sweatshirts, we have caps. Yep, so if you want to get something for Christmas, put your order in now and we can get it to you before Christmas.
Okay, early is better.
This is a completely unexpected little sales pitch, but that's a great idea, Aaron.
Well, it does. Yeah, I mean, funding is a big deal, especially at the moment, and that's a really easy way for people to support. and solves their Christmas shopping problem at the same time, which seems to get harder every year, I found.
Yep.
So, yeah, there we go. Problem solved. Yeah, two problems in one move.